Welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. This show offers an intellectual discussion on technologically enabled disruption, because investing in innovation starts with understanding it. To learn more, visit arc-invest.com.
ARK Invest is a registered investment advisor focused on investing in disruptive innovation. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK or podcast guests and are not endorsements or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Clients of ARK Investment Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
From ARK Invest, this is FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. I'm Brett Winton. With me today, I have Nick, who covers the consumer AI and internet space, and we're talking to Leif Abraham, who is the CEO of the investing platform and co-founder, co-CEO of the investing platform Public. Nick, lay out kind of for us the brokerage landscape, how it's changing, how you think about kind of like digital wallets and brokerage and Public and Robinhood. Give us this spiel.
I think we really set out last year around redefining what it means to be a digital wallet in 2026 or 2025 at the time. And the idea is really that the individual that is anywhere from 18 to 35, 40 years old is investing earlier, meaning that the brokerage is becoming more and more important. And I think if you were to ask us this question maybe 5-6 years ago, we would have focused more on the P2P payment space. But I think now what we're realizing is that the brokerage is ever more important, especially to the younger generation. And so we think if you can own the brokerage as a company, and you can own that amount of assets from an individual, your ability to on-sell additional financial products becomes easier. And we've gone through this period over the last 5-6 years in the fintech world where everyone asks themselves, is this a feature or is this a product? And we look at the brokerage as the main product that you can offer to an individual on the consumer side. And so then being able to bolt on features is really what excites us about owning that brokerage space. Public is a perfect example of a company that has really thought through, and you'll hear this in the interview, really thought through what it means to have lifetime value from a customer and making sure that your feature and product set really matches to what the end consumer wants from their brokerage and where they're really focused on. And Brett, you know, I'm curious what you thought from this was around their AI initiatives centered in the brokerage, because a number of different players are going after this. It seems like it's the next big thing in the fintech space to have like a personal CFO with you at all times. And that's really what we heard from the founder today.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of innovation is parsable from the lens of this is something that people have a lot of who have a lot of money pay a human to do on their behalf. And then the cost to provide that service declines to the point where people that have less money can still underwrite having that guidance. So, you know, in the digital wallet thesis and in the consumer AI thesis that we have that you've led. There's the idea of purchasing agents. Well, you know, purchasing agents have existed before kind of AI purchasing agents. It's like people would have shoppers. They would have clothes shoppers that would go out and find styles for them. And Stitch Fix kind of tried to package it together and we're going to send you like monthly boxes. And you know, there's been various like ways to try to do this. And this is really getting down to where it's kind of like you're paying the same amount for stuff, but you have expert guidance in doing it. And so I see this kind of personal CFO, or think of it as like a family office for the individual, for the middle class, where, you know, very high net worth individuals, they go and find an MBA out of business school and they say, run my portfolio for me and I'll give you some money. And the MBA tries to do it and balance their portfolio and stuff. And they pay the salary and they have so much money that it's, you know, worth it to pay the salary. But for middle class person, they can't pay a full-time employee to run their portfolio. But that means that their portfolio is not like optimally positioned to maximize kind of basically its compounding rate given how much they need in liquidity out of it. And I think the idea that Public is going after is, hey, you know, for actively engaged people, we can basically have that family office runner sit inside our platform or like a financial advisor. And it can get better over time. And that's the, I think the really, it's almost like this is an inevitable part of it, is that, you know, whatever they're offering today, the capability should expand over time. And ultimately that means like people's capital will be probably more efficiently deployed than it is today. It won't sit as much as in cash, you know, probably like investment dollars relative to the amount sitting in checking accounts will increase over time. And so you'll have more capital invested in the economy and the broad kind of money center banks will get starved slowly over time.
I like the analogy, you know, really what we're seeing broad base with AI, and we talk about it in this episode, is the idea that, you know, you are handing over the tools that the wealthy have always had because it's been locked in, you know, physical human labor. Now you're handing that over to everyone because you can replicate it with AI. And the financial advisor, I think, is, you know, at risk here over time as you have AI become very personal to the individual, understand more of the individual than a financial advisor could ever. It becomes a very threatening position. And a very interesting product that these companies can layer on to the brokerage.
So enjoy the conversation with Leif Abraham, the co-founder, co-CEO of Public, and thanks for joining the pod. Hello, welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. With us today, we have Leif Abraham. You're the co-CEO and co-founder of Public. Everybody's heard of Public, I think, at least in the investing world. Make financial markets more accessible to everybody. It's, you can invest on Public. It's a brokerage, kind of like Robinhood. You also co-founded AndCo, which was kind of like a, what, like a do stuff startup that Fiverr acquired. So welcome, Leif. Welcome to the podcast. How are you? And I know you know Nick, but Nick covers the, you know, consumer AI internet space for us, including the brokerages. So Leif, lay out, what is Public? Where is Does the total investing landscape sit today? How is Public positioned? And what do you think is going to happen both to Public and to everybody strategically on a go-forward basis, given where we are now?
Thanks for having me. So first off, obviously Public investing platform. And if you look at the investing platform space, first off, I think you have to look at the market in terms of what people have the ability to actually compound in the markets and not. And so you hear this term of like K-shaped economy a lot right now. And I think in the US specifically, that is very true. And the way we think about it, essentially, you have your kind of top 25% in the US of people that essentially make more than 100 grand. And they are also in the position to actually have money left over at the end of the month to invest and put it into the markets. And then you have the bottom 75% in the US that mostly lives paycheck to paycheck or even credit card to credit card, as horrible as that sadly sounds. And if you look at the investing space, you realize that, you know, that the top quartile is truly the one that actually has the ability to compound in the markets and to like truly build portfolios over time. And that changes how, I would say, platforms in the space design their products and, you know, what they're, you know, selling to customers, how you monetize them, et cetera, et cetera. And we are very much focused, you know, more on that top quartile. And that is also because if you look at the great wealth transfer, 85% of the great wealth transfer of the $100+ trillion that'll be passed down will be inherited by that top quartile. And so if you think from a business perspective, you know, of like where the market is and where the money is, so to say, in our space, that is literally where the money is at, you know, is really more in that top quartile. And therefore, when you design for that, you will make a few different design choices in terms of your product, right? So we always say this thing of like, you need to be a serious financial service you can trust with your life savings to really, you know, attract that type of audience. And, you know, that also trickles into things like, you know, what the actual products are that you offer and, you know, how you market, you know, how you speak to people in customer service, for example, all these little nuances, I think are kind of different if you're, you know, trying to acquire that kind of top part of the K-shape versus the bottom.
Wait, just as an aside, go on in a second, Nick, but K-shaped always bothered me because you have this part of the K, but then there's this big hard vertical line. Shouldn't it be like a greater than shaped economy or something? Like just,
Yeah, exactly. What's the thing called? Like when a stick has these two ends, you find water with or something. Whatever that shape might be called. Yes, I agree.
In thinking about your positioning in the broader fintech landscape, what do you believe is the core competitive offering that Public has that no other brokerage service has today?
I would say there's twofold. Number one, it's more on the fluffiness color of like who we truly designed for. And that is really the sense of building a serious financial service. And, you know, therefore just the investment into trust and security and, you know, the products that you offer. And then on a tactical level in terms of features, you know, we have done a lot of work, obviously, to kind of balance this notion of, you know, creating a very sophisticated platform in terms of, you know, data that you can access to, asset classes, you know, features that you have, but also keeping it very simple. And I think there's a difference between simple, like simplified, which is more like in your cash app world, when you kind of strip features away in order to make it accessible for certain people. For us, we need to have a certain amount of product depth to service the type of user that we're trying to acquire and we're kind of like designing for. And that changes certain outcomes. And that also dives into like when we look at, for example, the AI features that we're building, you know, is that our features are more geared towards folks that have some financial literacy, that want, you know, have more kind of active, you know, parts in their portfolio construction and so on. So if you look at something like generated assets, which is essentially a way for you to prompt your own financial product, you can, for example, just say, give me companies that are founder-led, growing more than 30% year over year, have no debt, and, you know, are based in the US. And it literally looks up those companies. Think of it as like a swarm of agents where like each agent is kind of like an own stock analyst, and it goes to the entire US stock market and finds those companies that fit that criteria, creates an index out of it, back tests it against the S&P 500, looks at returns and drawdowns, has a kind of like a relevancy score for that, tells you why these companies were added based off your prompt, creates a weighting on that. And then you can invest in that like just like you would invest in, you know, in any ETF that sits in your portfolio, and it sits the same way in your portfolio and such. But those types of, you know, products gear themselves obviously to people who, you know, have some idea of what they want to invest into. They have some theses, they are more active in their portfolio. And therefore, you know, there's a certain like sophistication level that we design for with some of these features. And that's, I would say, like, you know, the thing that we're very good at.
Are people using that? I mean, I think it's a provocative and interesting idea. And I think, you know, and there have been various, call it attempts to go after that idea of like build your own portfolio over time. I remember when ARK launched, there was Motif that was kind of trying to do it. I mean, not as frictionlessly, but a similar type thing. Yeah. And is like, and it's also, it's kind of like you're catering to this, like, you know, high income set, which is also the set that maybe doesn't have as much time to spend on investing. And also the way you describe that sounds actually more like a kind of retail type product. So how do I like reconcile those? And are you seeing traction? Does it work? Like, what do people appreciate about it?
Yeah, I say that. So a few components here, right? High income, I would put a caveat on that of like, you know, depends on how you define that. Like we define it as like someone who makes more than 100 grand a year, you know, which, you know, I think when you say high income, most people will likely have a different, you know, tier in mind there. And I would say like starting from that level, there's, you know, people that, you know, don't have necessarily wealth managers yet that, you know, have their own family offices or whatever that manages everything for them. Like they are more deeper in it. What we've seen really with this generation of what we define as like digital natives is that they are self-directed first. And so they want to have an active part in their portfolio. They are stock pickers to some regards. You know, they put some money into crypto. They are there for multi-asset and so on. But then parts of their portfolios are managed. And you can even make the argument, like the minute someone buys, you know, an ARK ETF that will be one of their positions, that they have opted into a managed strategy there by buying that ETF, right? And it's the same way for if they're buying, you know, generated assets or, you know, whatever else. And so we see it more as a thing of that people actively want to construct their portfolios, and then parts of their portfolios, like the parts in their portfolio, end up being managed.
How is Public the company using AI internally? Like, are you seeing like rapid product development internally, your ability to launch new features? I'm curious, you know, you're a founder, multiple time entrepreneur. Like, what does this moment feel like for you, seeing how AI is potentially proliferating internally at Public?
It's funny, man. Like, I would say that if I look at like the curve of AI adoption and also like the impact on the business, I feel like there was like, since ChatGPT came out and the first API connections and whatnot, it was kind of steady, and people use it for certain things of like, you know, some editing of copy and all that kind of stuff. And now I feel like in the last 9 months or so, it's going rapidly up like this. And that is number one. The obvious one is software development, you know, and in that, you know, we have engineers who tell me that they're now about 3 times more productive than before. I would say it's hard to really know. Whenever I hear some CEO going on an earnings call and be like, 50% of our code is written in AI, I'm always being like, that sounds like a great snippet, but buddy, we both know it's impossible for you to prove that. So I think that's one side. One thing that we're dabbling with right now, which is super interesting, is specifically when a PM, like when a product manager writes a bug ticket, that we actually have an agent, especially in front-end engineering, have an agent take that bug ticket, write already, like find the bug, fix it, write it, and basically leave it for an engineer to review and merge. And that obviously is insane, right? This is very early days now, but that is insane. And but it is working so well that we now already have conversations around how do we do this the most efficiently. Because, for example, I literally have like a little Mac Mini on my desk that I'm still trying to set up. But like when we literally like, where one of our engineers grabbed, you know, old, like just like old computers that we're not using from like former employees and stuff in the office, sets them up because it's cheaper to just spend $500 or so on like a cheap machine to have it run than having it run in like AWS cloud or so, because it's essentially like a month of workload there will cost you already half of what a machine would cost you. And so like, those are the conversations we're already having now, for having these like little agents, you know, already kind of like pre-do work and so on, which is insane. So that's one. And there's a lot happening in finance now too. You know, I would say like a year ago, or you know, a year and a half ago, everyone was still talking about how, you know, LLMs suck at math and all that kind of stuff. Now we have full processes in finance where, you know, full spreadsheets are being, you know, essentially maintained by mostly Claude at that moment, by the way. That is happening. Creative production, the last 3 TV spots we've done, the last 4 completely produced in-house. All of it is, you know, AI voiceover, AI music, AI imagery, AI animation. And then we have basically like one guy on the team who is just editing it together and, you know, compiles it and stuff. And like the idea and the copywriting still happens in the team, but all the elements are all being put together, are being produced with AI. Etc. So it's like it kind of touches everything, but I would say that the most dramatic shift really happened, I would say, like in the last 9 months or so. Like when,
I mean, one thing that, you know, thinking about putting those old computers to use, it's like the world is so starved of compute right now. Like it's so obvious to me. Like me 12 months ago versus me now, I have an agent running here doing some stuff for me. You know, it's like I am occupying some GPU in the cloud right now as much of like my work time as I possibly can, and really trying to have a few running concurrently. Whereas 12 months ago, it's like, you know, my machine was sitting idle and I wasn't calling on any cloud capacity. So, you know, just, and I'm not even, you know, at the leading edge of adoption here. You know, I'm trying to do it as fast as I can, but I know others are using it a lot more. But I think this is all a leading indicator to, you know, every employee will have some set of like, you know, transistors spinning for them or flopping for them, however you want to describe it, at all times. And that's like the future that we're gunning for. And then, so that's like the back end stuff. And what about the front? So you mentioned kind of like, using essentially generative AI to construct intelligent portfolios. You have, I think, Alpha, some kind of financial advisor type thing, or LLM that you launched a few years ago. How are you thinking about, and it seems like there you have to be somewhat cautious because, you know, financial services is a heavily regulated industry and, you know, people love to lose money and then turn around and be like, you cost me the money, therefore you owe me the money. So how do you think about kind of like extending that onto the kind
like
of front end of,
experience,
but, yeah, front end of your product offering?
Yeah, no, 100%. It's funny, like, I think what we've learned over the years, obviously to your point, like Alpha was like the first thing we've launched now. What was this, like 2.5 years ago or something, right? When 3.5 API came out and stuff. And there, I think what we've learned for ourselves is that when it comes to the point of information retrieval, we will likely always be behind and there's others who do it better. And, you know, the general LLM providers who are in the business of doing that mostly, I think will always be in the end better. And so like, I think the role that Alpha plays in the public experience is kind of evolving in the sense. And what we've seen is where public, where like AI within public and where we in our own product development can play a good role is in how AI sits on top of our pipes. So like on top of actual trade execution, you know, creation of financial assets. And so like within the regulatory wrapper, so to say, and, you know, within the pipes that we control. And one thing we're going to roll out in March now, which we announced last year, is actual agents that can run strategies on your behalf. And think of it as like when I launch it with like three capabilities. One is money movements. So think of it as something like, you know, whenever you see more than 20 grand in my checking account, move it into my, you know, top five positions. Make sure you only deploy the money if the stock hits, you know, 200-day moving average, you know, and then it's kind of running, moves the money in, puts it maybe into a higher cash account first, and then deploys it from there. That's like an agent that can just sit and run, right? That's like money movements. Then second is like trading strategies. And so that could be something like buy the sell and, you know, like, yeah, like buy the close and sell the open every day of, you know, the QQ. Use all my buying power. Don't touch margin. And then that's like an agent that runs, you know, or any other thing. I saw another thing right now, the other day, like some tweet where like Charlie Munger was like, if everyone would buy the 200 day moving average, you know, they would outcompete the S&P. And that's obviously something that's just hard to do as a human necessarily, because you have to stay on top of it. So that's an agent can do. And then the last is just alerts, because everyone might not be comfortable doing transactions immediately. So where then basically just like when an agent can kind of run these workflows and then just alert you on things. And so that's gonna roll out in March. And I think those are the things where we see more of like a platform shift in our space, where it really changes how you interact with your investing platform. And by doing so, moves people up the power user curve. And so people that might have been like very active in the portfolio construction and so on might become closer to the activity level of people who've been like online like API traders or so on. And people that have been fairly passive but understand general concepts around investing strategies become more active because now they can automate things. And, you know, the distance from I have a thought to it executes as a strategy just becomes much more condensed, right? And an example that I always make is like, I think there's a lot of people who know this concept, for example, of generating income with covered calls. But now looking at their portfolio and figuring out how does it work? How do I read these options contracts? You know, like what is really my income potential here? Like what if it gets called? Like all these things will, you know, and therefore it just never happens, even though they understand the high level concept, you know? And so now, talking to an AI and then having an agent execute these things on your behalf is obviously suddenly something where someone who understands a high-level concept, maybe not the details around it yet, can suddenly execute on those ideas that they weren't able to do so before. And it moves them up the power user curve and just like the sophistication of how they approach the markets in the first place.
Nick, this reminds me of kind of the purchasing agent thesis on the consumer side. Where, yeah, like expand on that or draw the analogy out there.
My question to it before we get in, let me just draw the analogy first. Purchasing agents, we believe that over time you'll have essentially an AI assistant in your pocket going out on your behalf, being able to make purchases across a variety of different marketplaces, taking, you know, essentially that execution layer out of the human loop. My question for you is, how ready do you think investors are to hand over the responsibility of execution to an agent? And what type of education do you feel that you need to bring to the market? Or are consumers asking for this? Because I would imagine, you know, asking a question, getting an answer, wildly different than, you know, telling an agent to go out on your behalf and move money around in the market.
Totally. And people are asking for it. They are asking for it, though, more from a perspective of that they, for example, write into customer service and being like, I need money freed up for a down payment. You know, can you check my, you know, tax lots? What are the ones that are long-term cap gains? Also, I don't want you to touch my NVIDIA position. And, you know, can you please sell this over the next 3 months? But maybe start with the stocks that are at all-time highs, you know? And like, and then in this case, like our CX team would be like, it sounds fantastic. I love how deep you are in your, you know, thinking about this, but this is not really what we do. You know, we're not your wealth manager necessarily, but people have those ideas, right? And I think what it then comes down to is, I think if you now, right now, talk agents, and the reason why, you know, I have Mac Mini on my desk is because when you think about, you know, OpenClaw, you'd be like, let's run this, please, in like some sort of isolated environment because you're scared of what it might do that you don't, you know beforehand. And so what we're starting here is really that it basically acts in these like very confined spaces, lack of better wording. And it's a mix of the agent being an actual AI agent and some things that are more deterministic, that are literally more, you know, if this, then that type of, you know, Zapier style processes that are happening in the background that you set up with the help of the AUM and such, right? And so therefore there are these like rigid workflows suddenly that technically don't have the ability to do something that you didn't tell it to do. And, you know, that I think, and you know, like that I think is one of the most important pieces for people to develop trust for these systems. Because if there's any slightest chance that it moves money in the wrong place or buys the wrong thing or sells the wrong thing at the wrong time, that obviously, you know, erodes any trust there and it will make you want to play it in some play money account somewhere. It will never make you want to do it in your actual portfolio.
Were there any legal hurdles you had to get over to launch this product into the market? Like, was your legal team like, oh my God, we're going to start executing on behalf of the customer? Like, if we mess this up, we're liable for X, Y, and Z? Or were they just totally okay with it?
Yeah, I mean, so you are still the one who is basically like who is approving the workflow, right? So how the system works is you basically chat back and forth with the AI. It basically asks clarifying question. Once it has enough to create a workflow, it gives you this workflow and tells you exactly essentially like what the decision tree is of how it will act, you know? Then even when it's, and then you literally basically like swipe to approve, and that swipe to approve is just like pressing a buy button for a limit order that might execute in the future, right? It's just a smarter limit order in that moment, so to say, you know? Because the criteria of why you make a transaction is maybe more complex or more creative, you know? But it's essentially the same thing like putting a limit order into the markets and executing whatever it does, right?
But it's definitely moving towards the like the terms of service that are in like 1 point font that are like, you know, a million instructions long, right? Where it's like, I have this whole complex set of things. It's like, yeah, I think that's it, right? I mean, I don't know.
It depends obviously on the workflow and stuff and like how deep that thing goes, right? In most cases, again, to my point, this will start very heavily with these like rigid deterministic workflows first, you know? And in most cases, I would argue that's we'll see what people come up with.
I think even beyond the kind of like AI agents making a mistake, there is a one like on the purchasing agent thesis. One thing that occurs to me with that is that, you know, I'm probably going to buy more stuff because of that, which is why there is margin in it for like why the retailers want to do it. Cause it's like, you know, my wife asked me to buy like a learning tower for our kid. It's like, oh God, now I have to research a learning tower. And, you know, and so it takes me weeks to get around to actually figuring out what she exactly is envisioning. But you could imagine sending out an agent to be like, figure this out. And then it arrives a couple of days later and like, oh, okay, that's great. That's probably what I wanted, you know? And so it just like reduces friction. But there it's very clear I'm paying money for a good and I know I'm paying some price. Hopefully it's negotiating me a better price. With financial services in particular, there's this funny thing where it's like all of the monetization is indirect. It's like, I don't feel like I'm paying anything, but I'm definitely paying something. And so then there is a fundamental, call it principal agent problem, where it's like money with you, kind of public as an enterprise or a bank as an enterprise, will always be incentivized to like shift the money in such a way that it maximizes their revenue. And so it's always like, and there's clearly ways users are currently have their assets, you know, set up where they're not actually maximizing, you know, there should be margin for you to take that also generates more money for the individual user, but it's getting across that kind of trust gap seems like a challenge, you know?
Yeah. In our space, you always have this tension between short-term revenues and lifetime value. And, you know, if you look at active trader platforms, you know, give you a very straight example, not to throw them under the bus, but like if you look at like Webull, public company, you know, spends $200 million a year just to replace churn. $200 million a year marketing spend just to replace churn. And that's because in the more active trading product and audience, your lifetime is maybe 18 months or 24 months, and you have to replenish the pool and you have to keep acquiring customers because people burn out and they lose money and they stop, you know? And so then on the other end, you have your, you know, Schwabs of this world that have potentially borderline infinite lifetimes because people will keep their accounts potentially for the rest of their lives, you know? And they just keep compounding and keep compounding. And so they are just different, like in our space, there's a little bit this like spectrum of different models that have different behaviors, and therefore, you know, you will monetize them differently and so on. And it's a little bit, as a business, you have to pick a little bit what side are you on in this space. For us, I would argue we sit a little bit in the middle of that. And so where, you know, there is an aspect of active trading.
Didn't you just say you have to pick which side you're on and then you pick neither side?
Thank you for calling out on that. It's a spectrum, right? And like you can move on the spectrum. But from what I'm saying is like from like a business model perspective, you have to figure out like, okay, you know, yes, you can juice your short-term revenues by pushing people into more speculative products or by trying to make them be more active and so on. But you're doing that at the risk of the lifetime value, because people will burn out and churn and so on, you know? And on the other end, you know, you can focus entirely on just, you know, lifetime, but then you have to make sure that the way you monetize them, you know, works out. Because if you're like a robo-advisor, for example, that makes 60, 70 bips on assets, you might have 7-year paybacks on those customers and you can't acquire anyone, you know? And so growth will be, you know, hurt by that as well. And so there is this balance that you really have to strike, and that creates these nuances of which products do you offer, how do you design, how do you market in terms of, you know, who do you bring in into the door, and therefore what behavior do they likely come with, you know, and intent do they come with. And as an investing platform, it's a spectrum that you have to kind of make some decisions on.
And how are you planning to monetize these agentic features? Are you, you know, thinking about a paywall, a subscription, or do you just look at it, this is going to increase the lock-in, make these users power users? Going back to your point, this increases the lifetime value. We're willing to give up the costs, run up expensive API bill with Claude, or with Anthropic. How do you think about the monetization?
Yeah, right now it's the latter. Right now it's the latter, and it's more of like, you know, we got to make these products, we got to get them out there, got to get them in the hands of people to also learn and, you know, improve them and so on, and also to see what provides the most value. And then if there's something we'll charge for in the future, I will not say no to that right now. Maybe that might happen, but right now it's really about, you know, like, you know, getting these products to market and maturing them over time. And then there's an obvious aspect here for us is that, you know, if you have a bunch of agents set up on public, you can't transfer those over to another brokerage, right? And so it's a little bit like, these are like unique to public. And, you know, if you just have a few stocks and ETFs in your portfolio, you can ACAT that over to any other brokerage tomorrow, right? But if you're bought into the public platform, even on this like kind of user interface level of I'm using these agents, I have these workflows set up, et cetera, that obviously locks you in much, much more into being a customer for long.
Do you think your agents will need to have a personality in order to complete that lock-in? As in, I think there's a fair assumption that there's going to be a lot of people with AI girlfriends and boyfriends in the future, and that these AI agents, at least on the purchasing agents on the consumer side, like part of the platform lock-in is going to be like, this is, I trust this voice, and it's going to be, I trust this image and video. Do you think you'll have to kind of push in that direction as well? Does public need a personality?
Man, super, I love this question. It's like super, I'm fascinated by it. I'm fascinated by it from a perspective of when we talk about what needs to get done to essentially replace financial advisors, not what needs to get done, but like, you know, what AI needs to be able to do in order to replace financial advisors. We talk about these like three things. There's the grunt work that they're doing of like tax loss harvesting, we just talked about, like things like that, you know? And then there's advice, which is essentially like opinions on the back of data and research and news and market movements and so on. And then there's emotional support. Of like, who do I call when the chart looks red and it points down to the right? And, you know, like, I need my emotional support. And the grunt work is basically the one we're starting with agents, you know. Then advice becomes a trickier one, I feel, you know. Because, again, there's a lot of opinion-based backed into that as well. And comes a question of risk level, et cetera, et cetera. And of what good or bad, good versus bad advice. And then the third one is where exactly the personality stuff comes in. You know, where it's like, okay, you know, how is this something that I can talk to where I get some like emotional support when the markets are red or so? And, you know, and then it becomes this thing of like, how do you pick your bank off? Like, do I vibe with this or not? And so on. And like, how do you figure that out? And like onboarding, for example, like you acquire a new customer, you know, how do you test drive three different personalities of, you know, virtual, you know, wealth managers and stuff. Like, it's super fascinating. But I do think we're going to get there. Like, back to your point earlier of like, there's already people who are starting relationships with you know, AIs. And I think, you know, I would argue humans are maybe emotionally simpler than we sometimes might want to admit. And those are the first inklings where you see that. And with that in mind, I think that number three of those three, I think there's a chance for that to actually be even easier than number two, than the advice part. As weird as it might seem at first.
Yeah, and why you have an AI girlfriend who's separate from your financial advisor when they can be one and the same.
Doctors, you know, doctors, I'm gonna talk.
Okay, so the other like big thorny kind of like emerging area in technology and investing space is stable coins, crypto assets, DeFi. You have all this AI stuff going on. The entire kind of like underplumbings of the financial system is potentially changing here. How do you think about kind of like the strategic stance against that? Where is this going and how are you positioning against it?
As someone who runs an investing platform, I can obviously see a lot of benefits in the monetization of the stack through just general blockchain technology and so on. And there's efficiencies to be built. There's, you know, if you look at a crypto trading platform versus a stock trading platform, you know, a crypto trading platform is kind of interchangeably be an exchange as well as a broker as well as, right? So all these definitions kind of start to blur a little bit. And it's because technologically, you know, it's so to say much simpler and so on. And there are a lot of efficiencies to be gained. But I see that as like marginal expansion for a business like myself. The end user doesn't necessarily see many of these benefits quickly, I would argue. And I don't think they would care either, you know, of like what rails their trades and say execute on, as long as it's, you know, great quality of execution and things happen secure and the way they want it to. Now, where I find it very interesting is that if especially on things like getting other asset classes tradable. And so if you look at private assets, and private assets obviously is a super diverse kind of topic, right? You go from private credit to private companies to potentially art and, you know, royalties or whatever else you find, you know? And right now, it's obviously a hodgepodge of how you get access to those. I could totally see essentially tokens to be the kind of unified wrapper that brings this all into one big liquidity pool and brings it all into like one type of way of how it's traded. And obviously in that way, you want it to be something where multiple brokers can tap into. So you have the best liquidity pool that is there. And so things like, you know, assets being pumped up very quickly because float is very low and stuff, that you bring those risks down, but just the matter of having a larger liquidity pool there. I think that would kind of need to happen. I think that is what will make it hard, because I think right now, every broker like myself or any other exchange or whatever, everyone will want to build their own first. And it will take likely a few years for all those to then to start to partner and to, like, you know, recognize that I think together that will actually start to work versus everyone working on their own thing. So I think that will need to happen there. And I can like go on a rant now, 50 other things. We're going to stop there for a second, but yeah.
Where do you land on prediction markets? Thinking of another emerging market, some of your competitors have leaned in quite aggressively. Where are you in the prediction market journey?
We will do something in prediction markets also at some point, but prediction markets I see is like, first off, events contract is an instrument. And then there's a question of how that instrument is used. And you could argue that maybe right now the use of that instrument is potentially being stretched, let's call it, you know, to essentially, let's be straight, like to do a regulatory arbitrage for sports betting and stuff like that, you know? And I think there's an aspect of what we hear from our customers is that they don't like the idea of seeing sports betting in the same platform as they have their retirement account and so on. And that is something that, you know, one of our customers kind of look down upon and such, you know? And so we will not end up, you know, putting sports betting into the app, like that's not going to happen. Now, I do think there's a lot of interesting use cases around kind of dissecting company events into the stock page, you know, and, you know, other events that are somehow related to your portfolio, right? Which could be political events, could be FOMC meetings, you know, and so on. And so there are things like that that I find very, very interesting. But I think right now, you know, the use of instruments is just being stretched to a way that potentially will hurt the credibility of that instrument, generally speaking, you know, in the long term. And I think that's something to really watch out for.
Yeah, glad to hear you say it, because that's how we view the market. Like, the idea that prediction markets are a huge opportunity, fully bought in, but the idea that sports betting is going to be that opportunity couldn't be more bearish. Like, I think it is nonsense to think that sports betting is the final, you know, this is the market. Really, it is what you described, where you can unbundle the derivatives contracts that surround single stocks and make those events available to individuals that would have to use an insufficient instrument, as in a put call around a single equity, to if they have a thesis. So it's great to hear you say that.
And also in that moment, like all the insider trading discussions that are going on, right? And so on, yeah. Around this and so on. Like, if you focus in on the markets that already operate in these regulatory like frameworks, you know, then those issues don't really exist in those.
Right. Right? Exactly.
They exist if you're trying to bet on Dancing with the Stars, you know. And I totally agree that, you know, it shouldn't be a Dancing with the Stars to now, you know, regulate information flow of, you know, of a production of some knife event or something. Like, those are the things where it becomes tricky, you know?
I'm glad, because it's surprising to see these companies lean into the sports betting side when the opportunity set is just not there. Like, if you look at sports
betting, but all of the volume is there right now. That's the problem.
But if you were to look at the longer term, like, imagine these companies, they're very smart. They're thinking about the long term. Sports betting opportunity, maybe $500 billion end state. That's like gray market. If all of the United States legalized, that's what you're looking at. Derivatives is a $750 trillion annual volume industry. So, like, why they're so focused on sports betting is beyond me.
But that's also because the spreads on sports betting are better, like as in that you can get a much better take rate. I mean, I 100% agree. Like the future of this is basically like a risk transformation that doesn't currently exist in very crude instruments that we have today. Like you could imagine, you can look at, like we've done it a few ways, like look at the amount of kind of insurance premium paid out to basically allay risk against like the underlying assets, or look at kind of derivatives markets relative to notional. And you do end up with a very large prediction market, basically eating all of the margin out of those non-market-based risk transformation functions that happen. And right now, sports betting is like the place where the liquidity is. I mean, so the bridge between here and there is kind of interesting. I think it's going to happen. Like, you know, you can imagine you could decompose Tesla into Tesla, the cash flowing business, and Tesla, the robo-taxi opportunity, and Tesla, the Optimus opportunity, and have different kind of like ideas relative to the market of the odds of those things happening at what time. And then it becomes like a more fine-grained instrument by which to play those specific exposures you want.
It is a fantastic example because there are so many conglomerates that have, you know, evolved, and like even SpaceX is becoming one now, right? Where it's not just one business anymore, you know? and I think that's exactly it, of like being able to like dissect the opportunities within these like larger companies, you know, I think it's a massive. Now on the sports betting side, it's also, again, it comes back down to the decisions that you have to make as a business for who you designed for, and this balance between short-term revenue potential and lifetime value of a customer. You know? And it's just, you know, everyone who runs these companies will make their own decisions. We make ours. You know, I want to build something where we, the last investing account they've ever opened, and I care about the top quartile and like trying to own that, you know? And in that, people care about the seriousness and the trust of their investing platform. You know, if your main user base is the bottom 75%, more middle America, so then through speculation is also how you monetize these customers, right? Because they will not have the money to compound in the markets. And so you need to either sell them loans, get interchange from credit cards, or, you know, sell them something speculative. Because when a paycheck comes in, chances are they have a few days to play with that money, and then they need it for, you know, to put food on the table and pay the rent. And so you need, so it's just how you, you know, how it's a sad thing, but that's how you monetize in, you know, those users in the end. And so therefore, I can see why some platforms that have more access to those user bases make the decision to go deep in sports betting, because that's how you monetize those users.
Closing off here, strategically, how do you make decisions on like deepening product versus breadthening into other areas, other asset classes, or maybe other financial services? Like, what is kind of your guiding principle as you look out, you know, 2 and 3 years as to what Public's going to become? And 2 and 3 years from now, what is Public going to become? Or is it just the same, even better? What is it?
The way we think about it is, if you look at the top quartile, their financial life evolves around their investment assets. And so therefore, even like the checking account kind of sits separate from that, for example. You know, like when a paycheck comes in, they literally like had this thinking of, I will put money away. I move it somewhere else. And then it sits there and it stays there and it will compound and I put it to work. But I will likely never move it back. I will just keep it there and compound it. Maybe when I buy a house or something, another asset, you know, I'll move it into another asset. But generally speaking, I'll compound my portfolio. And then in that mindset, it's really, if it's something that helps or is like centered around your portfolio, it's likely a feature or a business that we will go into in the future. That's how we roughly think about it.
In Public 3 years from now, what should we look for? Why should I become a Public customer? And then what benefit, other than the, I don't know, financial advisor that has a great personality that's automatically provided to me, what else should I look for out of Public?
So first off, the last time when you had some tech issue with your incumbent, that was likely yesterday, then, you know, you might want to switch to a platform that was built this century and has a tech stack that is completely built in the same technology. That's, I think, is number one. But generally speaking, again, like our whole thing is that, you know, we are the best place to build a multi-asset portfolio. And we'll keep building out features and, you know, technologies that help you to, you know, get the most out of the markets. And that comes from the AI tools we're launching with the agents, generated assets, and other things that are in the works. And I would say, like, if that is what you're into, then we're the best place for that.
Oh, everybody likes making money. I like making money, so maybe it is what I'm into. Okay, Leif Abraham, thank you so much for joining us on the pod. Enjoyed the conversation. It sounds like exciting times at Public and for the markets in general. A little choppy right now, but hopefully we'll like smooth out a little bit over the next
over
month
time.
Or so.
We'll all come back.
Yes. Time is our friend. Okay, thanks cool. for joining
thank
us.
You. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FYI, the For Your Innovation podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please hit that like button and make sure to leave a comment down below letting us know what you thought. And if you haven't already, please make sure to subscribe to the show and follow us at ARK Invest on your favorite social platforms so you stay up to date whenever we drop a new episode.
ARK believes that the information presented is accurate and was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information, and such information may be subject to change without notice from ARK. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this podcast may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions, and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements.